If you're gonna break another heart, then break it. Come on and break it. If you're gonna take that kind of chance, then take it. Go on and take it. Anything I say or do will make no difference. In the end, you'll go ahead and do what you really want to do. If you're gonna break another heart, then break it. If you're gonna take that kind of chance, then take it. You are free to take it. But don't come running back to me.
That's a selection from Mama Cass's rarely heard album, The Road Is No Place for a Lady. We're playing some more from Mama Cass, a bit scratchy, but hey, it's authentic 1970-71, and a little moody, but hey, up with the swine flu, getting everybody freaked out, maybe folks are in the mood for a little nostalgic, melancholic reflection as we bomb the hell out of Afghanistan, and continue our occupation of Iraq. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. You're talking with, or perhaps listening to, and able to talk with, Robert Norse. That's me. Call-in number here is 427-3772. You're invited to call in if you'd like to do that. And as mentioned before, we will have a guest on at 6:30 if he calls up, hoping he will. I think he's up in Portland or thereabouts. Maybe even in the East Bay. He's one of the founders, if I'm not mistaken, of Rose City Cop Watch. Rose City is Portland, Oregon, as well as the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. And I will be reading some selections. Actually, I'm going to try to read one of his articles from 2003, a monthly review article, in about 10 or 15 minutes, because it's struck me as being so pertinent to current situation, not just in Santa Cruz, but in other cities across the country, around the history of policing and how our own mythology interferes with our understanding of what really happens when police bureaucracies form, and what policing really has meant historically and what it means today, as distinguished from really protecting public health and safety. And I'll be talking about, actually I'll be reading Christian Williams' take on that, and then we'll be talking to him at 6:30. But right now I'm going to be making a few announcements. So let me do that. Let's see here, shifting mics, but hopefully not losing you. There we go. I think we're still on target here. On Sunday, we're going to have a couple of upcoming things I want you to be aware of. For those of you who follow this show regularly, I do a show twice a week, from 6 to 8 on Thursday and from 9:30 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon on Sundays, sometimes coming in a little early to bump or debate with or seize part of or get the input from Thomas Levitt of The Wake Up Call, who begins his show much earlier at 7:30 on Sunday morning. But on Sunday, a couple things are coming up. The Cop Watch that we at Human Rights Organization and Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom do have been doing pretty regularly every week has numbers of interviews that come up. And I began this last Sunday at 10 o'clock, and I'm going to try to make it a regular feature. Every Sunday at 10, I'm going to try to play the interviews we did on the street the day before. It looks like Cop Watch may be rained out this Saturday. Normally it's at 5 o'clock in front of Borders, a bookshop in downtown Santa Cruz at Pacific, between, I guess it's Walnut and Soquel, if you know where the Borders bookshop is in downtown Santa Cruz. And we're on the streets with a table. We interview people. We follow the police if they show up to keep an eye on how they treat people on the avenue. It's not your Cop Watch where we, you know, use the scanners and go to sort of crisis situations, because rarely does a crisis develop in the way that we can actually do that. And in a way, that kind of Cop Watch is kind of outdated, because people have cell phones that take pictures, even video now. And so anybody with a cell phone can actually capture what the police are doing. We don't need to run there with a video camera, but we still do use video cameras in order to keep an eye on the routine harassment and violation of basic rights of poor people that happens daily in Santa Cruz. And it's really important to bring that to the public notice, even if the courts don't give a shit or we don't have the financial resources to bring it before, up to the appropriate level of constitutional scrutiny. Not that the Roberts Court, that's our Supreme Court, would necessarily give it the right scrutiny anyway. It'd probably give it an extremely right-wing scrutiny. So anyway, 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, playing Cop Watch tapes. Now, we actually did a Cop Watch yesterday, because of those of you who follow Indie Bay, and perhaps you listen, those who listened to the Sunday show, last Sunday show, know Bernard Klitzner, Bashful Bernard, as I call him, of the Human Rights Organization, announced his determination to do a protest protesting the city's 1 hour on a bench limit that was set by the Santa Cruz City Council in a kind of a, I don't want to call it back room, because they did it in an open vote, but the whole thing was cooked up behind the scenes with no meaningful public input other than the Downtown Association, Chamber of Commerce, Santa Cruz Neighbors, the groups that believe in kind of giving the police more power to criminalize homeless people as the way to deal with their economic and, psychological paranoia problems downtown, as well as to pretend to deal with real issues of real conflicts that come up downtown, which are another matter entirely, but, aren't being addressed really at all through this approach, other than through driving people away with the notion that this is somehow going to make it a safer, serener, more comfortable downtown. I guess for those who just want to go shop, that's all they want to do downtown, and walk to their cars and or do their little work and then go home. I don't want to demean work. Do the work downtown they need to do to survive and pay rent and, in some cases, perform valuable services and then go home. Those who believe that the streets are only for those purposes, I guess maybe they're all happy that the streets are being depopulated of poor people. I'm not. I think that everybody not only has a right to be there, but it's helpful for everyone to be there for the entire community. But who knows? We'll see if my opinion is a majority one or not as the economy dives deeper. Anyway, on Sunday at 10 o'clock, we'll be playing Cop Watch stuff. So the Bashful Bernard's bench protest, the various interviews that I took, I think it was mostly myself. I did some audio recordings of people interviewing folks who stopped to give their opinions, some critical, mostly supportive of Bernard's protest. In essence, he sat on the bench for 2.5 hours, 2 hours at least. And the police refused to ticket him, they refused to arrest him, they refused to respond to citizen complaints, as did the host. So if you're a merchant and, you file a complaint about someone, you can be sure the police will be there fairly quickly, not always, but usually, and often in great numbers or greater numbers, and seems to be justified by the event. But if you are someone they recognize and they don't want to write you a ticket for, because even if you're violating exactly the same law, they know that you have an ulterior motive, which is to show that their law is unconstitutional or to make a point of how stupid they're being by giving out such citations, then they will avoid it and they'll simply go after the poor people that they want to get rid of that are the real targets of this law. In this case, two musicians, Jeff, who used to hang out on the bench near Verizon, and C.J. Stock, who hung out on the bench that has since been taken away, that used to be outside the what they call the Bazaar. Not sure what the name of the store is, right outside Pacific and Walnut Streets. So, anyway, those tapes will be played on Sunday at 10, not now, because I'm kind of pushing for time to get a few other things done. I will also be playing an interview with Vernon Rodriguez, who says he was the first person arrested at the Republican National Convention protests last year. And some of this is mentioned on Indie Bay. If you go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, you'll find some discussion of this, too. So you can check that out. Also, we'd like to announce that a week from today, Sarah Barnes, who's an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. I may have that name wrong, but it's some such group up in San Francisco, helpful in helping the Fresno homeless stop the Fresno police from seizing their property. In fact, finding for a $2.3 million judgment on their behalf, getting Judge Wenger to find that judgment and essentially spotlighting the city's anti-homeless policies and causing them to stop their attempts to pass anti-homeless laws like a sleeping ban. Sarah Barnes will be on my show by phone talking about the situation in San Francisco and considering also some suggestions for here in Santa Cruz, which she's looking into as a possible arena in which to fight laws like the sleeping ban, which is being done in Santa Barbara with ACLU support down there, and Sacramento by Mark Maron. Laguna Beach, as you may know, was successful in fighting its sleeping ban. So that'll be coming up next week at 6:30 on this same station, in the same show. So tune in for that. Right now I'm going to play a few interviews that are mostly, we're going to kind of blast from the past, not very far in the past, though. This is, I believe, April 17th, and we'll be looking at or listening to some drum circle stuff, which has actually been very good. The drum circle has successfully gotten the police and the city employees to stop putting up the mesh fences, as those who know reading the City on a Hill press, or got advance notice by reading Indie Media know right now, or knew before. People stood firm. They weren't intimidated by Sergeant Harms, who went around taking notes on people, surveilling people, arresting a few people.
Whoa.
Looks like we have a caller here, or at least I thought we had a caller. Try calling again, caller, if you want to get in touch. But let's begin a few of the interviews. I think this is April 17th, interviews from the street.
And take a picture of you, even though...
Here we are at the New Leaf Market area as the sun just disappears kind of over the horizon. And, of course, approaching us is the notorious Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Robert.
So it's actually not the drum circle, and it's not a Wednesday. It's 17th, which was a Friday, and it's in front of New Leaf Market, where musicians often do gather, actually on a nightly basis.
And, of course, it's around 7:25, and actually there are genuine, what we call them, street people, dread
transients.
People. Transients. Utes, undesirable transient elements, folks of the sidewalk, the homeless, whatever you want to call these gay guys or these gals. What's happening, Sam? Give us the update.
I wanted to ask you a question.
By the way, it is April 17, 2009, for those of you who are wondering.
Is it illegal for a cop in uniform to walk up to you while you're in a park and take a picture of you, even though you're not breaking any laws or doing anything out of the norm?
It's not illegal for anyone to take a picture of anyone else in a public place. However, if the officer then puts it in some kind of a file, that might be illegal or inappropriate. I guess what you might want to do is put in a Public Records Act request to find out, you know, where your picture is gone. But will they answer it?
How will I go about doing that, and how much bureaucracy am I going to have to fucking go through?
Probably lots. Well, first thing you want to do is inquire about police procedures in the Santa Cruz Police Department regarding photographing individuals who are not suspected of any crime. You might want to ask which officer took a picture of you.
We took a picture of him. I forget his name.
You might ask his sergeant. You might say, "Officer, I want to talk to your sergeant." And ask if the sergeant, you know, the officer is taking photos of me. I'm not apparently suspected of any crime. I'd like to know what's going on and get a statement from the sergeant. That would be one thing to do, if the sergeant chooses to talk to you or even show up.
Well, the only reason he could give us for taking the picture was that...
He's a wild photo bug.
No, in case that any illegal acts happen later on in future, he'd be able to hold it up as like a lineup without us physically having to be there.
Which, of course, is an utterly unconstitutional and ridiculous reason for taking a photo of innocent people. It's an invasion of privacy. It's the presumption of guilt until proven innocent. And also it can involve keeping political files on people. I mean, that's my reaction. I'm not speaking as an attorney. I'm speaking as an ordinary, Joe Blow character who doesn't like that idea at all.
And he said there was currently no investigations going on.
So suspicious until proven innocent, eh?
Pretty much.
You know, I don't really like that one, and I don't know if it really passes constitutional muster. I think that...
Well, and also, is Loud Nelson private property, or
no,
is that
it's
park?
It's a public park. It's
yeah.
Open during the day.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So you are not engaged, unless he...
You weren't engaging in any illegal activities or harassing anybody.
Are you known for your illegal behavior, Sam? Have you gotten citations in the past? For what? What crime?
Sitting on a planter box.
Sitting on a planter box.
The only one I've gotten.
Criminal behavior on Pacific Avenue, I suppose.
I don't know if that's necessarily criminal, but according to,
According to the Downtown Association.
According to the ordinances and the rules, yes, it is illegal.
By the way, have you seen the police wandering the streets today, or...
I've seen a few, most of them in cars, none of them on foot. See more detectives about plain clothes.
Plain clothes, really. Yeah. You know what they're seeking information on? Perhaps more photos of you sitting on a planter box?
I'm hoping it's just parole and probation violators.
Hi, Cracky. There's that questionable Tamarack playing the drum there, as you can see. Well, Sam, I agree I have no more information for you on that, but if you want to bring the issue to the Human Rights Organization every Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, you'll find possibly a cup of cocoa waiting for you, as well as another one of our endless agendas.
That sounds very exciting.
Indeed.
And we actually have a caller. Somebody's listening to our show. What's your name, caller?
My name is Stephen Piercy.
Hey, Stephen. You must be, and I recognize your name. You're that famous scoundrel who is putting up pictures of, or I should say, effigies of...
Display of a soldier from the house. That was the
6 years later, there's still...
One that generated controversy in Sacramento several years ago.
Your house was... You got some serious threats for trying to dramatize the...
Right, I think it was during the peak of the pro-war movement.
Yeah, it seems like we're still in the middle of the pro-war movement, except it's now sort of in a pro-Obama, pro-occupation, I don't know what it is, movement.
Exactly. Fortunately, the political sentiments within the public are more consistent with where my sentiments were back then, but...
I hope so. I don't know that we're actually doing anything to initiate real action around those sentiments. But
exactly. I just think that if you spoke with the majority of people today, they would probably agree that we should not be in Iraq. Although that doesn't seem to be.
Well, just leave it to Obama to get us out.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know. I imagine that the majority of people would not want us, for example, selling arms to Israel to be used against children if they really knew that all the details. But
well, don't forget AIPAC. They might want us to.
That's right.
Yes. That's the American-Israeli Political Action Committee. Is that right?
American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Thank you.
The biggest lobby group, I think, in the country.
But I think you mentioned, because I cut you some of what you were saying off air, that you were concerned about, or you had some thoughts about this business of police photographing folks in a park who aren't doing anything illegal.
So when I was listening into your show and I heard the tape of that interview with the woman, it struck a familiar chord because I used to organize demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations in Sacramento at 16th and Broadway, and the Sacramento police would routinely come out and park the car, you know, nearby and point the camera at everyone while they were engaging in a lawful anti-war activity. And we used to go up to the car and take a camera, and we'd go up and ask the cop, you know, why are you filming us today? And they would typically have answers like, one time a cop said that the reason that they were filming was because they had gotten a call from somebody who drove through the intersection and was concerned that they saw some children crossing, stepping outside the crosswalk, carrying flags and signs, and they thought it created a potential for danger to the children. But in fact, they were routinely parked out there from the very beginning of the demonstration to the end, and long before anybody would have had a chance to call, before any of the protesters arrived. They were like the first people.
Are you calling from Sacramento? Or?
No, I'm in Berkeley right now.
So let me ask you about this, because I know that political protests, we understand that there's this abuse of individuals in order to, you know, criminalize them, and political protests discourage them, and I suppose the police would rationalize it by saying, they might commit an illegal action, we've got to have all their faces, so if one of them does, we'll know who he is or she is. But this is a park where a bunch of poor people are hanging out. I guess some may be smoking marijuana. I don't know. You can be there after hours, after dark. That's illegal in Santa Cruz to be in a park after dark.
Mm-hmm.
But does that happen in Berkeley, too, or in Sacramento, for that matter? Do the police go around photographing people, just poor people, you know, in a park?
Well, I haven't ever seen, you know, I haven't ever been in a place where there was not... where there was a cop filming, where there was not some kind of just maybe a protest action or a gathering of some sort.
Mm.
I mean, they may very well drive out to the homeless camps, for example, in Sacramento and film them routinely, but I'm not out there to see that.
Uh-huh.
I do see them at gatherings. Like, it sounded like when you were interviewing the woman, it sounded like there was some kind of a gathering. I'm not sure, but I heard the drums in the background. Maybe it was just one person playing the drums. But
well, actually, that was a gathering, but she was referring to a prior incident that had happened at another place.
Okay.
They
seem to justify it, you know, on the same basis, whether it's a gathering or maybe if it's a homeless camp, I guess they might refer
now,
to
you're
it.
You're an attorney, right?
Right.
What do people have, as a man who, you may have studied the law on this, you may not have, and there's a lot of areas of the law, do the police... are they vulnerable to, of course, these are budget times, so you might say, what kind of a waste of money is this? But are they vulnerable to, you know, invasion of privacy type lawsuits? Or are there any kinds of restrictions statewide or constitutionally that people could raise and say to the police officer, you know, if I'm engaging in a crime, sure, photograph me as evidence. But if I'm not, you know, you can photograph me, I guess, as a private citizen. We can all photograph each other. But as an acting police agency, in order to keep it in a file, isn't there something? What kind of recourse?
Well, like, for example, in the context of a gathering, you know, at the gatherings that we had, 16th and Broadway, in the context of a demonstration, I think the argument would be that when they come out there and film us from the very beginning, they're creating this
chilling effect.
Chilling effect, and creating a deterrent and sending the message to people. Basically, they're sending a message that as long as you're out here doing this, you're going to be subjecting yourself to investigation. Because when you're being filmed by police, it's you know, presumably
sure.
part of an investigation.
But isn't this also, I mean, it's a higher standard when you say, okay, we're just middle-class people doing a protest. What about it? What if you're grubby lower-class people just trying to hang out in a park, not doing any particular protest? Do you have the same kind of protection? Can you make the same argument? You're chilling our right to be in a public place, or is it not really the same kind of constitutional argument?
Well, I guess it might be tricky. I can't think offhand of how you would hang your hat on the First Amendment issue in that context, but the invasion of privacy issue that you referred to, like, you know, people in their homes, if the police drove by and, you know, took a camera and pointed it into your window while you're inside your home, that would be considered probably an intrusion on your justifiable expectation of privacy.
So just buy yourself a home and you're all set.
So, yeah, and so typically when you're out in a public place anywhere, so if you're living out in a public place, you're still in a public place. I guess it becomes more difficult because of the Supreme Court precedent regarding public places and the fact that...
You mean more difficult to hold the police accountable and to stop them from doing this?
It's more difficult, but if there's some kind of political conduct associated with it, I think then you can...
So we should advise people who are hanging out to have a political sign with them.
Something along those lines. I guess the it might be difficult to, you know, to spin it that way if it's purely about people living somewhere. But if you have a gathering out in public, I would think that in the same context that we have, although it could be about challenging the anti-homeless laws that they're enacting.
I've got to cut you off pretty quickly. Is there anything else you want to conclude with?
Well, I think that this story, this person that you're going to be having on in a little while regarding Cop Watch, that's also something that I wanted to tune in for because of what happened recently in Oakland and how...
Oscar Grant and...
Oscar Grant.
And Lavelle Mixon, both.
And then the whole thing about whether it was appropriate for those cops to storm into the apartment to go after
Lavelle Mixon.
Right.
Yeah. Let's bring it up, and hopefully you'll be able to call in again if you want. I'm hoping we can get this second line available, that he'll be calling in another line. Hopefully you'll be able to call in, and others will too.
It sounds like a great guest.
Hope we can get back to you at that point.
Okay.
Thank you, Stephen, and keep up the good work.
All right. Bye-bye.
And I'm now going to read a little something because I am expecting a... Here we go. Is that the right... here we go. I'm expecting a call shortly, hopefully without a lot of feedback, from Christian Williams. But let me read you a little something that he wrote, which you can download or you can actually go to. It's called The Demand for Order and the Birth of Modern Policing. You probably put that phrase into the Google. Or the name Christian, K-R-I-S-T-I-A-N, Williams, you'll be able to find this article. This hopefully will be a good introduction to his own discussion when he calls in. Why were the modern police created, he writes. It is generally assumed among people who think about it at all that police were created to deal with rising levels of crime caused by urbanization and increasing numbers of immigrants. John Schneider describes the typical accounts. The first steps were legal and administrative, and their focus confined mostly to narrative descriptions of the step-by-step demise of the old constabulary and the steady but often controversial evolution of the professionals. Scholars seem preoccupied with the politics of police reform. Its causes, on the other hand, were considered only in cursory fashion, more often assumed than proved. Cities, it would seem, moved inevitably toward modern policing as a consequence of soaring levels of crime and disorder in an era of phenomenal growth and profound social change. And that's by John Schneider, a quote there. Christian Williams continues, I will refer to this as the crime and disorder theory. Despite its initial plausibility, the idea that the police were invented in response to an epidemic of crime is, to be blunt, exactly wrong. Furthermore, it is not much of an explanation. It assumes that when crime reaches a certain level, the natural social response is to create a uniform police force. This is, of course, not an explanation, but an assertion of a natural law for which there is little evidence. We cannot rule out the possibility that slave revolts, riots, and other instances of collective violence precipitated the creation of modern police. But we should remember that neither crime nor disorder were unique to 19th century cities, and therefore cannot on their own account for a change like the rise of a new institution. Riotous mobs controlled much of London during the summer of 1780, but the Metropolitan Police did not appear until 1829. Almost 50 years later. Public drunkenness was a serious problem in Boston as early as 1775, but a modern police force was not created there until 1838. So the crime and disorder theory fails to explain why earlier crime waves didn't produce modern police. It also fails to explain why crime in the 19th century led to policing and not some other system. Furthermore, it is not at all clear that crime was on the rise prior to the creation of the modern police. In Boston, for example, crime went down between 1820 and 1830 and continued to drop for the rest of the 19th century. In fact, crime was such a minor concern that it was not even mentioned in the city marshal's report of 1824, and the city suffered only a single murder between 1822 and 1834. And I remind you, the Boston police force was created in 1838. according to Kristen Williams. Whether or not crime was on the rise after the introduction of modern policing, the number of arrests increased. The majority of these were for misdemeanors, and most related to victimless crimes or crimes against the public order. They did not generally involve violence or loss of property, but instead were related to public drunkenness, vagrancy, loitering, disorderly conduct, or, quote, being a suspicious person. In other words, the greatest portion of the actual business of law enforcement did not concern the protection of life and property, but the controlling of poor people, their habits, and their manners. Sidney Herring, Riley notes, the criminologist's definition of public order crimes comes perilously close to the historian's description of working-class leisure time activity. The suppression of such disorderly conduct was only made possible by the introduction of modern police. For the first time, more arrests were made on the initiative of the officer than in response to specific complaints. Though the charges were generally minor, the implications were not. The change from privately initiated to police-initiated prosecutions greatly shifted the balance of power between the citizenry and the state. A critic of this view might suggest that the rise in public order arrests reflected an increase in public order offenses rather than a shift in official priorities. Unfortunately, there is no way to verify this claim. The increase in arrests does not provide very good evidence, since it is precisely the fact which the hypothesis seeks to explain. However, if the tolerance for disorder was in decline, this, in fact, coupled with the emergence of the new police, would be sufficient to explain the increase in arrests of this type. And I think that's our author calling in. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, this is Christian Williams.
Hey, Christian, it's Robert Norse, and you are attuned to, in fact, we're tuned to you, and you're speaking live on Free Radio.
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm good. Have you been listening to us on the air or not?
I haven't, no.
Okay, well, I've just been reading from the beginning of your article from the, let me read this. The title of it is The Demand for Order and the Birth of Modern Policing.
Uh-huh.
And I like it. I like it.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're welcome. So, I don't know where to start. I actually was going to read more of it because I think it really gives a, your book is a little hefty to master. I have not actually gotten through your entire book. You're the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. And actually, that's been out for about 5 years now? Or
the first edition came out in 2004, and the second edition came out in 2007.
And is there a lot of difference between the two?
No, it's basically the same book. There are just a couple places where it's been updated.
Okay. I think I have the 2007 edition, which, by the way, for those listening, is in the Santa Cruz Public Library. Okay, and I'm hoping that if somebody wants to call in the midst of this, and don't call in immediately because I want to talk to Christian. I'm pronouncing your name properly, Christian?
Yes, you are.
For a few minutes before we get calls, but I do want calls as well, and I'm a one-man operator here, so I'm going to have to manage that, but I will. I usually do. Let me begin with. Can you still hear me now?
Yep. Okay. That's much clearer.
I just turned it up. That's why you can hear it. I stopped reading from this article a moment ago as you were on the edge of talking about the Cleveland Police Force and the Golden Rule policy.
Uh-huh.
Maybe before we begin, I mean, I don't mind, we're going to the specific very quickly. I think a lot of what interested me in your book was the exploding of a bunch of basic myths that a lot of us, myself included, believe were kind of secondhand facts, like, you know, the police are a dangerous profession, and you actually devote a significant amount of time, and I've talked about this on the air a week ago. I played some of your Oakland lecture that you may remember at the Commonwealth Club or something?
Something like that, yeah. The Continental Club.
There you go. And you also, of course, talk about that in your book, that professions like truck driving and farming are significantly involve a higher, much higher percentage of fatalities per 100,000 people than policing or fire.
Yes.
And you're doing a sort of a similar demystification job on the history of policing in this article, and it's all kind of it's frankly much more manageable to me. Do you have that the I'm wondering if you can kind of give a summary of the of what you think are some of the most significant myths that need to be addressed if we're to understand how the police actually do operate and perhaps what our alternatives are.
Sure. The biggest one, and this is really the one that the thesis of the book goes after, is that the police are primarily concerned with crime. Or, you know, public safety or something to that effect. It turns out that if you look at how they actually operate, both at the level of, individual police action and also at the level of, the organization's, policies and procedures, that sort of thing, but especially at the level of the institution as a whole and its development over the past couple hundred years, the law and crime and concerns for public safety turn out to be very weak indicators of what the police are actually going to do. You're much better off if instead of looking at what the law says or what's been demonstrated to address crime or something like that. Instead of looking at those things, if you look at the distribution of power within the society, and pretty reliably, the police tend to do things that preserve the existing distribution of power, which means, in effect, that they act in ways that continue existing inequalities. So, overall, the police tend to behave in ways that give inordinate attention to people who are at the bottom of the social hierarchy, people of color, poor people especially. And they tend to behave in ways that protect the interests of people who have power, elites, rich people, people who have influence in the government. So, you know, the big myth, I think, is the idea that the police are primarily there to guard public safety or, uphold the law. And as I argue in the book, what their main function is actually, the preservation of, inequality as it currently exists, especially in terms of race and class.
And you write a lot, at least the one of the things that interested me particularly was your focus on the enforcement of these petty laws. We call them, they're infractions in Santa Cruz. We recently have a bunch of new laws that criminalize almost all sitting on public sidewalks other than very limited zones, panhandling, spare changing, street performing, political tabling. All have been severely limited in terms of the location you can do it in, the times you can do it, and so forth. Not that the police spend a lot of time going after it, even if they see it, but if there's a complaint from a merchant, let's say, they will almost immediately enforce it, or at least I can't say that for sure because I'm not, omniscient, I don't know, but it's my impression.
Well, one of the effects of those sorts of petty infractions is that, this actually speaks very well to my point. They make it so that there's almost endless list of things which are technically in violation of the law, such that most people, just going about the course of the day,
are violating a law.
Violate the law,
in the course of the day,
and usually without even knowing it, and usually without it making any difference to anyone. Mm-hmm. Now, what that means is that it becomes literally impossible for the police to enforce every law under each circumstance, right? They would be doing nothing but issuing traffic citations and going after jaywalkers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So necessarily the police are going to have to rely on their discretion to decide when it is that they enforce the law and when it is that they let it slide, which means that the real effect of that is that it makes the actual dictates of the law less important than the police officer's own judgment about who he's going to stop. And it gives him the pretext, almost always, to stop somebody if he feels like he should. So, by multiplying those little infractions and making it very difficult to be always in technical compliance, it has the effect of giving the police this enormous amount of power to just by their own discretion, at their own whim, decide who to stop and search and that sort of thing. In New York in the 90s, this was pushed as like a policing strategy. It was the zero tolerance approach, or the broken windows theory.
Yeah.
And the idea was that the police would focus on small things and prevent big things from happening. And the mechanism, or one of the mechanisms by which this was supposed to function, is that by doing things like paying attention to jaywalking and noise complaints and drinking in public, the police could then use that as sort of an entry point where, you know, they see somebody with an open container, they stop, they write them a ticket. That gives them the opportunity to search that person. Maybe they find something, you know, illegal, or maybe the person is on probation and they should be drinking anyway. And it provides this sort of entry point where they can then selectively investigate people for more serious offenses, and the portions of the population that get more police attention it provides the means for the police to sort of keep them in the system, to keep them,
running to court.
Being searched, going to court, you know, having warrants, being on probation, in some sense under the overall supervision.
Well, let me ask you, though, as a devil's advocate here, and because I found myself trying to do this with your book at different points, because, you know, I tend to be, you know, sympathetic with, I think, your concerns. I'm also involved in a cop watch here in Santa Cruz, and, you know, I like the, the general tenor of what you write, but I want to make sure that, let's suppose we had someone who said to you, well, look, you know, yeah, Giuliani was a tough-ass character. He was the mayor of New York during that time. The Santa Cruz City Council has voted to make it illegal to sit almost on any sidewalk in town near a business except for selected places on Pacific Avenue. But if this, in fact, does reduce crime generally, isn't it a valuable thing to do, assuming you want to agree with the reduction in privacy and everyone wants to agree to be able to pay to sit down in cafes or keep walking or sit on the disappearing benches, of which there are less and less in Santa Cruz?
Right. There are two kinds of responses to that. One is that it raises questions about justice and fairness and equality and the kind of society that we want to be living in, because it's not simply that the burden of those kinds of policies are shared by everyone. They get selectively shared. Like, zero tolerance is a misnomer. It's really a heightened level of selective enforcement. And the people who tend to suffer most are the people who tend to suffer from other social disadvantages already. So it tends to be poor people, people of color, especially the homeless.
Yeah, if you're out in public, you're necessarily more of a target.
The second kind of response to that is to look at the actual numbers of what happened in New York during the 90s. Because New York gets put up as this...
the model.
And it's referred to in the literature as the New York miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And and it's true that reports of serious crimes went down during the time that Giuliani was in office. Now, what's not so clear is whether there were actually fewer crimes committed. And part of that is because Giuliani, or actually his police chief, William Bratton, implemented this management program which rewarded precinct commanders that had good crime statistics and punished precinct commanders that had bad crime statistics, which built in this inherent incentive to find ways to skew the numbers. And during those years, on more than one occasion, commanders were caught fudging the numbers and forced to resign. Since then, the police union has come out and said that, has complained that during that period, the low-level officers were getting pressure from their commanders to report thefts as lost property, to report batteries as assaults, to report homicides as accidents, things like that. And in fact, William Chambliss has done a study comparing the homicide rate in New York during the 90s, which should be the best, most reliable set of statistics, the ones that are hardest to fudge. Comparing the homicide rate, which was going down during the 90s, and the suicide rate, which coincidentally was going up at exactly the same rate. So it's not clear whether crime actually went down or not.
What's the relevance of the different suicide and homicide rates?
Well, homicide rates are supposed to be the most reliable indicator of violent crime because they're the most reliably reported because there's a body, right? Now, if the homicide rate is going, meaning cases that the police investigated as a murder, if that's dropping over a period of time at exactly the same rate,
I catch your drift. You're saying that maybe homicides are being characterized as suicides,
right? Exactly.
Okay, that's what I was wondering what the story was.
Yeah. I can't say 100% that that's what was happening, but
you raised that question.
It's striking, and it certainly fits into a bigger pattern of other ways in which the statistics were being skewed. So the evidence that the crime actually went down based on this isn't particularly good. I started by saying that there were two ways that you could respond. I think the third way you can respond is that it isn't surprising that the empirical evidence for the crime rate dropping that doesn't really hold up, because the theory that it's based on is so sort of off-kilter. The broken windows theory basically holds that small signs of disorder, things like graffiti, loud parties,
homeless panhandlers,
homeless people, and broken and literally broken windows, are precipitants of major disorder, things that don't directly cause but do contribute to this environment of uncontrollability that then leads to real crime. Well, if that's true, then it would seem to follow from the theory that public resources would be better spent on the state's welfare functions rather than on its policing functions. Doing things like providing shelters and job programs and, help providing government funds to help poor families keep up their homes. And, fixing literally broken windows.
Well, isn't it? But unless you can terrify people into leaving areas entirely and turn them into gated communities for the rich.
Right. So, I mean, just on the basis of the theory, there's no reason to rely on the state's policing function rather than on, and in fact, there is some empirical evidence that, that increased social spending does a better job of controlling crime than increased funding of police departments. If the idea is to simply gain control of the physical space and to displace the troublesome populations, then zero tolerance policing can do that. But it does, but, I mean, again, remember, that's not actually doing anything about crime, right? That's simply moving the population out of the area. And, you know, if, as the broken window theory would seem to have it, that, you know, that the disorder that accompanies that population is the precipitant of crime, all you're going to do is displace the crime. You're not actually going to reduce it.
Well, that's an interesting question. See, that's an empirical question, which isn't which hasn't really been investigated. We tried to get the Santa Cruz Police Department to give us stats as to whether there. We have a law that was passed by our ex-mayor Ryan Coonerty of the bookshop Santa Cruz, who's the son of the owner and a longtime manager there. I'm not sure what he does now, but he's part of the family business. The law was specifically that you're not allowed, and it's still the case, in any of the downtown parking lots. If you walk into a parking lot, you have to walk directly through without stopping. And if you're there to pick up a vehicle or to park a vehicle, that's all you can do. You can park or retrieve your vehicle. You try to read a book in your vehicle, that's a criminal act. If you try to nurse your baby in a vehicle, that's a criminal act. If you try to chat with a friend, if you try to give a First Amendment speech about, you know, the rights of man, that's a criminal act. All these things are criminal acts. And now it essentially amounts to about 10 square blocks downtown that can take up all the parking lots and garages, of which there are about 24 in the downtown area. And the argument there was, well, this is going to reduce crime. And the police then claimed that it had, but they refused to give statistics. Uh-huh. They just said anecdotally it's reduced crime. But if, you know, there is, I guess there, I mean, we said, well, more eyes on the street means less chance of crime, but the other argument is, well, these poor people are just a bunch of criminals anyway. If you get them out of here, you'll get less crime, I guess is the general.
Right. That's the unstated theory underneath the broken windows theory.
Right.
Is that, explicitly what it says is that these small signs of disorder, you know, create an environment in which crime is more likely to occur. But the subtext is the notion that it's just poor people themselves that cause it. And the broken window theory has just worked hand in glove with urban renewal and gentrification efforts basically everywhere that it's been implemented.
It doesn't
get traction where there isn't an economic development incentive.
Going back to your essay, which I really find a useful kind of tool here, you talk about the Cleveland police in December 1907, adopting a golden rule policy. Rather than arrest drunks and other public ordered offenders, I'm reading from your article, police mm-hmm. walked them home or issued a warning. Year before the policy was established, they made 30,000 plus arrests. Only 938 were for felonies. That's, you know, one-thirtieth of the arrests. In the year after the Golden Rule it was instituted, police made about 10,000 arrests, one-third as many arrests as they had before, and again, about 1,000 were for felonies. Other right. cities implemented similar policies, in some cases reducing the number of arrests by 75%. I think we're going to make you police chief of Santa Cruz. That's my plan.
I'm afraid it probably wouldn't help. I mean, first of all, I wouldn't take the job, but secondly, to go back to, you know, myth busting, the common theory of why we have bad policing is that bad people become cops and then we have bad policing. But actually, I sincerely believe this. I believe that people who become cops mostly become cops with the best intentions in the world. They want to be helpful. They want to do something good for the community. They believe the sort of crime-busting mythology. And they enter these institutions with the idea that they're going to do good. And what happens isn't that bad people join good institutions and do bad things. It's that good people join a bad institution and do bad things.
Agreed.
And getting rid of, you know, there are some, there are certainly some, especially administrators, police leaders, who have managed to make things considerably worse than it was before they got there. But there are not that many who can make them considerably better. And even the range between the two, it's not that different.
Well, what about this Cleveland police policy change? Was that initiated by the police department, do you know? Or
yeah, it was the...
They ran out of money? What was the problem?
The police was a sort of progressive reformer who had this idea that it would be, you know, better or more humane. And surely, you know, it was. Like, it's more humane to walk a drunk home than to throw him in a cell, right? But
was it cheaper? Was it cheaper to do that, or?
I don't know.
I mean, frankly, I'm looking for some new ideas for, you know, downtown Santa Cruz, and I think this kind of suggest. I mean, this is not only an interesting case in point, but might be an object lesson for us today, those of us who are, you know, raising these issues.
Right. But the overall function of the institution was basically the same.
Say that again.
The question here is,
go ahead.
What wasn't, you know, whether the police were going to be controlling the lives of the poor. It was which approach to control they were going to take. So, you know, again, it still had the, you know, the same sort of class biases and the same sort of protecting the interests of the wealthy and the powerful. It's just that they were doing it in a gentler manner.
Again, I guess some would argue that arresting drunks and public order offenders doesn't just impact the rich and the powerful, but impacts everybody in the community. That is to say, it may not be the best way to deal with a problem, but it is one way to deal with a problem that arises. It isn't always like a demonstration against the rich. It can be, you know, it can be petty crime against other poor people. It can be, you know, problems that develop on the street. It can be just public drunkenness that develops. What would you say about that?
Well, but, I mean, part of the question there is who defines, and this is implicit in all the public order policing kind of approaches. The question is, who defines the standards of order? And in many cases, it is the standards of order are defined in ways that disadvantage the poor, immigrant communities, minority communities, any community that has norms internal to itself as far as public behavior, which may differ from the norms that the powerful elements of society want to impose on them. I mean, in the 19th century, this was really conceived of as an effort to sort of tame the poor to Americanize this wave of immigrants, the Irish and the Italians especially. And so, you know, things that that the immigrant working classes just considered a normal part of their culture, right? Associating, you know, on the street, drinking, gambling, things like that. The native-born Protestant ruling class considered, first of all, morally offensive, but secondly, saw that it had a vested interest in maintaining a workforce that was disciplined and sober and conscientious. And so the public order policing of the 19th century was really this programmatic effort to instill by force the sort of the Protestant ethic in the new immigrant population.
And would you say that's still the motivation in places like Giuliani's New York and, I don't know, Mayor Matthews, Santa Cruz, and I don't know, where are you calling from?
I'm Portland, Oregon.
I don't know, what's the name of your mayor?
Sam Adams.
Adams or Portland, is that still the case? Are you thinking an ethic is being instilled here?
There's definitely a disciplinary element to it, like in the sense of trying to instill discipline in the workforce. And there's definitely still the manner, the issue of sort of imposing standards of order that are different than the actual, like, you know, the community has standards of order, but the standards that are imposed by the police are often quite different, such that in, you know, for example, in Giuliani's New York, things that had previously been considered just like nuisances or inconveniences or, you know, part of the vibrancy of the city were suddenly considered criminal. And, you know, for people who participated in them, people who, relatively frivolous examples, like people who enjoy loud parties and skateboarding, those things weren't signs of disorder. They were
signs of life.
Part of the fabric of social life.
Mm-hmm.
For people who, you know, relied on panhandling or washing windows to make their living, those things weren't signs of disorder. They were, you know, what made life possible.
You're talking about people, homeless people who wash windows of cars in urban areas, right?
Right.
For donation. Go ahead.
Well, when those same sort of tactics got imported to San Francisco, almost immediately after they were taken up in New York, the explicit aim was really, the explicit target was really the homeless population. And it was, not only things like panhandling, not only things like sleeping in public, but even things like serving free food were suddenly treated as criminal offenses. And so there were dozens of arrests over a few years of the police arresting people
hundreds
for
of arrests,
the crime of serving free food.
I know. I went to jail for it myself. But
you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. There were more than 1,000 arrests of Food Not Bombs food servers between 1988 and 19... Well... They have continued sporadically, actually, into the present. You also write that, again, going back to this 1907 Cleveland instance where, by changing the policy, instead of arresting drunks, you escort them home, suddenly arrests drop by a third. You mentioned that this example demonstrates official tolerance can reduce arrest rates, and then this explains the rise in misdemeanor arrests during the previous century, that because if tolerance can reduce arrest rates, it makes sense that official intolerance could increase the number of arrests. And you point out that, I guess, the rise of policing has to do with kind of the ability to use power to enforce a kind of control on the population and redefine things as criminal that weren't previously criminal, as you just mentioned, right?
Right. I mean, the case that I was making about the 19th century was that, partly what I was doing was I was re-examining the statistics that are used to tell the story about how the police came about. I mean, the typical story is that those immigrant working class populations brought with them this, like, crime wave. And that out of that, out of the social pressure of the crime wave, the police were born. Well, it turns out that most of the crime wave consisted of the things that we were talking about, things like drinking in public, things like, you know, gambling, sometimes simply being a suspicious person or vagrancy or that sort of thing.
You also talk about prostitution as well in New York City. I'm jumping in here because I want to throw in some new stuff because of time problems. During the first half of the 19th century, apparently there was complacency toward prostitution. It became one of, I'm quoting you, moral panic beginning in the 1830s when reform societies took an interest. It was widely claimed prostitution was approaching epidemic proportions, although that there was an increase from 600 prostitutes in 1806 to 1,200 in 1818, and maybe even 5,000 in 1856, the city's population jumped more than six times between 1820 and 1860. And so there's actually a relative decrease in the number of prostitutes relative to the population. I guess you're pointing out that there isn't a real increase even in the so-called criminal behavior, which may in fact just be ordinary behavior that's part of a certain culture frowned on by some, tolerated by others. But even that is not really increasing at the rate which the police are claiming or certain historians are claiming has happened.
But, I mean, really what changed wasn't the public behavior. What changed was the enforcement. The crime wave wasn't there. I basically run the argument the other direction, that because the new police existed, there was, you know, predictably going to be an increase in the number of arrests. And part of that was because they were enforcing laws that previously would have gone unenforced. Then that poses the further question of, why did the police arise at a particular time that they did? And I argue at some length in the book that it has to do with the if we look at what they actually did was control the lives of the working class. And because of urbanization and industrialization, there were new sort of class dynamics that required a new institution. And adapting the previous institution that they had, the slave patrols, they developed the modern version of the police force.
We're talking with Christian Williams, who's the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm actually hoping we can get some people to call in and ask you questions if they want, Christian.
Sure.
And there is another number to call in. I'm hoping it'll actually be able to do this. Sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. We'll see. The number is 831, and for locals, 469-3119. For those out of the area, 831 is the area code, 831-469-3119, if you want to talk to Christian Williams. So feel free to give a call with questions you may have. You also mentioned, Christian, that interesting changes, again, I'm looking at your article. In the early 19th century, Boston's laws prohibited only habitual drunkenness, but in 1835, public drunkenness was also banned. Alcohol-related arrests then increased from a few hundred each year to several thousand. And then in 1878, police powers were extended even further as they were authorized to arrest people for loitering or using profanity. In Philadelphia, meanwhile, and so on and so on. So are there instances of that more recently, in the last 20 or 30 years, in other cities in this country that bring home the same point?
Well, I mean, we've largely been seeing a replay of the same sort of dynamic, where, things which were either illegal but not enforced or not illegal are suddenly being made illegal. So, for example, in Portland, we have a law that's called the Sid Lie Law, which makes it illegal to sit on the sidewalk or lie down in a public space.
I think you got that from Santa Cruz. That wasn't previously illegal before, and it's true.
No,
in Santa Cruz, that law came in 1994. Of course, they put it forward as an appropriate regulation of time, place, and manner of public use of the public spaces.
In Denver in the 80s, loitering was made illegal again and hadn't been legal for almost 50 years because of constitutional problems, I should mention. It was scrapped originally because of, being constitutionally vague as a notion. What does it mean to loiter? It means to be there. Right?
Without apparent purpose or means of support, yeah.
There's that sort of thing. There's also, shift from, public drunkenness to open container laws, where it's like, well, you don't even have to be intoxicated, you just have to have it open, or
open
going
container.
From drinking in public to an open container law, where it's not that they have to see you consuming the alcohol, you just have to have the alcohol in a container that isn't sealed.
Very good point. Do you have any stats about when these open container laws came in historically? Because I know that's used a lot in Santa Cruz against poor people.
Yeah, no, I don't know off the top of my head. There are those sorts of things. There are also things that, you can make a public safety argument about, things like, bike lights, but that often have the effect of, adding to the police discretion so that, not every bike that doesn't have a light gets a ticket, but the cops decide which one to do.
Or seat belts and helmets and things of that sort.
I mean, there's clearly, there clearly has some public safety benefits, but it also has this undercurrent of extending police discretion.
Let me move to another area, although if you want to finish up with what you're saying, please do that.
No, that's fine.
You've been working with Rose City Cop Watch, or you began working with it some years ago. You were a founder, or?
Yes, I helped start the organization about 5 years ago.
And because I know there have been cop watch efforts in different cities. I was born in Portland myself, actually. I was just itching to get away from Portland, Oregon, as they say. Actually, no, I kind of like Portland. I haven't been back there much. But there are some cities like Fresno, which are looking to get police review boards to oversee the police as a way of somehow making the police more accountable, or police auditors, which are a weaker approach, or
right.
even independent prosecution of police officials, even independent prosecution of presidents. What a concept. You take a rather different stance on how to proceed with this. One might even say an anarchist approach.
Mm-hmm. My own position and Rose City Cop Watch's position as well is that rather than focusing on reforms and, you know, sort of legal investigation and that sort of thing, that what we fundamentally need to do is find things that the community can do directly that will shift power away from the police and toward the community, with the ultimate aim of abolishing the police altogether, finding other means of securing public safety and keeping order and that sort of thing.
In your speech in Oakland, you stated, you gave two examples of where this has happened in Ireland, where the Irish Republican Army had to find ways of dealing with crime in the areas that the British military and the British constabulary and the, I guess, the Ulster folks did no longer controlled. And I think you gave some other instance, too.
The two instances that I really go into in detail in the book, one is the in militant areas of some of the cities in Northern Ireland where the British just gave up policing, partly because it was dangerous, but more cynically because they thought that without crime control, crime would fester and it would
assist
destroy the communities that the Republicans were relying on. Mm-hmm. And the for a period, the IRA handled crime in those areas the way it handled most things. Which
by
was,
warning
was
them
violent.
And then breaking people's legs, as you put
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. But that had bad political consequences for them. It meant that they had...
they were regarded as
less
thugs,
less,
right?
Yeah, public yeah. support. Yeah. So in the 90s, Sinn Féin approached some conflict resolution experts and asked them to design a justice system that could operate out in the open and would be legal and would not rely on violence and would have, you know, safeguards for rights and all that sort of good stuff. And the IRA could get out of the crime-fighting business.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with a program called Community Restorative Justice Northern Ireland, which in extensive consultation with the people who lived in these areas, they came up with, you know, a system for addressing disputes between neighbors, disputes within families, serious allegations of harm, theft, debt, you know, the whole sort of array of things that that you would want a justice system to take care of, and to do it in a way that was above board and legal. And
was there a professional bureaucracy involved in the system?
There wasn't. It was totally deprofessionalized.
Did it involve accusations, juries? There was no. Was there a system of law involved? What was
the approach? Isn't one of punitive justice. It's not a matter of catching the bad guys and punishing them. Mm-hmm. It's explicitly restorative, meaning that the idea is to...
Providing restitution.
Yeah, find how the harm was done and see what you can do to make sure that it doesn't happen again and heal the damage that's been done.
Sounds like kind of tribal, early tribal approach where you want to, you know, give whatever recompense is necessary to the injured family. In some cases it might be vengeance, in others it might just be paying them off, something like that.
Yeah, these things definitely exist sort of on a continuum. They implemented this in four or five pilot projects, and it was immediately copied by people in other cities in other neighborhoods besides the official pilot project ones. And everywhere that it was implemented, it was really, really popular.
How can people get more information on this system, by the way? Is there a website they can go to? Or?
Oh, there are. I don't know the URL just off the top of my head.
What should you Google for as a name?
I will look for Restorative Justice Northern Ireland.
Okay.
I went looking for criticisms of this, and literally the only criticisms I could find were from the police. And the only criticisms that they had was that it was making their jobs impossible. So even the probation office had good things to say about it.
Well, you know, after reading your book and then picking up the newspaper from yesterday and looking at the Chronicle plans, slashes, numbers on parole and prison, the prison guards are claiming, this plan to essentially not a very small number of people on parole and in prison. It's not very significant in my mind, but I tend to find myself thinking that your argument is kind of cutting against the whole progressive movement of the last 150 years, in the sense of those who believe that government can initiate. Well, I guess maybe you're attacking the policing function of government, but are you going after something more fundamental here?
That's a good question. And I'm deliberately looking at, in this book, it's the police, and my second book, American Methods, I also talk about the military and the prison system. I'm particularly interested in the coercive aspects of government. The other sort of regulatory bodies or the service providers, I don't have necessarily the same sort of principled objections to, although I am often very suspicious of the way
the welfare system operates. Or
yeah, the way it, especially the way it's used
child protective
to regulate
services,
the people that it's supposed to be serving. But my politics are primarily anarchist, but.
And anarchist, for those who don't know and are listening to this, is reliance on community consensual activity rather than the imposition of force and violence from a structure of government, right?
Right. And I'm pretty sure that it's possible in a hypothetical anarchist society to have things like the water department and the public library and that sort of thing. I'm pretty sure it's not possible to have things like the police and the military. And so whether you call what's left when you strip out the coercive aspects a state or not is, I think, just sort of a linguistic quibble.
It may not be possible because of all the tumult that was happening, but there's often a lot of focus for those who are idealistic anarchists to go back to the Spanish Civil War, and particularly the Spanish situation in the summer of 1936, mm-hmm. when there was anarchist revolution in some of the cities, Barcelona, Homage to Catalonia, famous George Orwell book I'm sure you've read.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if many people, I wasn't alive then, and I only know what I read, but you do a lot of historical research. I go back to that. There was a society where they, for a while, briefly, they threw out, at least in some places, existing authority. And in some cases, it was rather violent. Of course, they were fighting back against a counter-revolution that Franco eventually won, the fascists eventually won. Do you see any evidence for any of your propositions that regarding the police department that we've been talking about, that the police tends to it creates more crime, it creates a job for itself, it essentially is an instrument for a class oppression? I guess you probably use the same kind of analysis for places like Cuba and former Soviet Union, maybe China.
I would tend to, although I haven't, you know, done the same sort of research on the policing systems there that I have in the U.S. I mean, I've mostly focused on the coercive aspects of the U.S. governmental system, partly because it's where I live, and so it's the, you know, the thing that I have experience with, but also because, you know, it's the most powerful government in the world, and so what happens here is disproportionately important for people everywhere.
In Portland, how are your how has this perspective been received? I guess by both by people, you know, in the I don't know, progressive community, and by the folks at large, by people who work there, by people who live there. I mean, are you regarded as is this considered an outlandish theory? I guess it's a theory probably that very few people read about because I don't know how widespread it is. Are you getting much play in the media up there?
Me personally or CopWatch?
Well, you personally, CopWatch, the propositions presented in your book that, you know, a whole new system of police-less community security and community protection is required.
Well, it's certainly a minority view, but it's one that I think people often find
provocative,
intriguing if they can get past finding it shocking.
Uh-huh.
There are people who just, I mean, the orthodoxy is that, you know, the police are just in. Inevitable part of society, and that there's no point in, you know, wondering, you know, whether we could do without them, because it's like arguing against aging or something. But, you know, actually, that, you know, part of the argument of my book is that the cops have only been around in their present form for a couple hundred years, and if social change 200 years ago could produce this new institution that has the power and the significance that it does, then further social change should be able to get rid of it. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who the challenge is really one of imagination. It's that they have trouble conceiving of how we could do things differently. It's not that they're particularly committed to the institutions that we have. And so, you know, laying out on the one hand, laying out a careful, thoughtful argument about what the possibilities might be often gets a relatively warm reception, even among people who disagree with it. On the other hand, you know, I don't just have, like, a program that I can, you know, of, like, this is exactly how we could organize, you know, our society right now that we can, you know, get rid of this, that we can get rid of this institution. And that's often what people want. Like, when they say, well, we have it said, they often don't want to hear about, you know, the broad possibilities and the historical antecedents and the, you know, what people have tried under other circumstances and that sort of thing. They just want an answer. They just want, like, a policy decision. Like,
right, or they want, you know, put up or shut up sort of thing.
And unfortunately, it's not just that I don't have one. I think that in order to...
To find one, it has to come out of changing circumstances, too, I think.
And it's going to have to be very sensitive to the local conditions that it's operating in. So even if we had something that was working that, you know, would do that work perfectly well in Portland, there's no guarantee that you could just, you know, import it.
And yet you mentioned that in Ireland, a system that you think might actually serve that purpose, and you also mentioned South Africa's reconciliation commissions, too, or...
Well, before that, there were the street committees, which
street
were
committees, right.
These directly democratic, very localized bodies that would again, do the same sort of dispute resolution and also handle, you know, sort of normal neighborhood crime and, you know, look into allegations that people were informers for the police and that sort of thing. And also, like, worked on primarily a restorative model, although the street committees were more prone to using violence than the Restorative Justice Ireland program was.
Sticking tires around people and burning them, that sort of thing?
That wasn't usually the activity of the committee itself, but, yeah, I mean, the reprisals against informers were pretty severe.
I mean, that is one of the, you know, chief arguments about people who say, oh, you want to have a, you know, a communist society or a more egalitarian society, or you want a society without policing or without differences in wealth and where everybody, you know, has access to the resources they need. We've seen, you know, vast tyrannies develop instead with that kind of ideology claiming to be at the forefront, if you're talking about the Soviet Union and China and Cambodia or Kampuchea, as it was called then. And, you know, you get, or even Cuba, if you're gay, you know, good luck. So that kind of history tends to turn people off to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it's anything that you should rush into blindly. Like, I think there's a pretty straightforward test for that sort of thing, which is that the institutions that we propose replacing the institutions that we have with need to be able to withstand the same criticisms that we level against the existing society. So we need to hold ourselves, or, you know, we, broadly speaking here, need to hold ourselves to the same kinds of standards that we expect, you know, the institutions that we have to uphold. So, you know, so the things that we want of, like, you know, transparency, accountability, you know, democratic control, basic fairness, like, those have to be built into the institutions that we develop, just as much as we demand them from the society that we have.
And again, getting back
to... we should have higher standards for
revolutionary
groups.
We're talking with Christian Williams, Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. Christian is spelled K-R-I-S-T-I-A-N, which is a good way to Google him and get some more information both about his book and also to hear some of his discussion about Rose City Cop Watch, which I'm going to ask you about now. You've actually given some interesting discussion to different groups. You talked, as you said at the very beginning of this interview, you said, you know, you referred back to the Oscar Grant murder by Johannes Merzli up in Oakland on January 1st, and then the behavior of the media and the community. You didn't refer to it, but I noticed it in the killing of Lovell Mixon and then the four police officers that he allegedly killed and probably did kill, though not necessarily. Who knows, you know, all the details on that.
Right.
What's Portland Cop Watch or Rose City Cop Watch doing these days? How does it operate? I've been talking about our own Cop Watch, which is pathetic and very limited and is really more of a sort of a sounding board for getting out a few stories about how the police are treating people downtown and the occasional posting on indie media. In Portland, you got presumably more organization and more people involved. How's that going? What's happening with Rose City Cop Watch?
Well, we're a relatively small group. We have a solid membership of, I think, 10 people at this point, and a larger volunteer base that we mobilize for individual projects. And, you know, we have some sort of stable aspects to our work where we, you know, offer training in what your rights are when dealing with the police, and we teach people how to safely and legally observe the police. And then we also periodically go out on patrols and document what the police are actually doing.
You follow them with scanners, or how do you go to the appropriate high conflict points?
We've tried various strategies for that. The one that we've used most and probably most successfully is looking for places where we've been getting reports of a lot of police activity, or looking for events that we know are going to attract a lot of police attention.
So the last time you had a large cop watch or a cop watch where that worked was how long ago?
Oh, a couple months ago. I guess it was almost 6 months ago now. We had a sent a crew of people down to cop watch outside of a football game at a predominantly black high school, which doesn't sound like it should attract a lot of police attention, but boy does it. And so, you know, there were a lot of cops, and they were basically there just to keep an eye on, you know, the kids who were watching the game. So we monitored that situation and, you know, used video cameras, took notes, talked to people about their experiences with police when things were quiet, that sort of thing.
You also mentioned that some years ago you effectively exposed police officers who shot two people in the community using the system we actually used in Santa Cruz in 1992. I guess it's not that unusual or that you know, novel, which is the we pasted pictures. I didn't do it, but others used the picture I took to wheat paste a wanted poster for officers Lauren Baker. We call him Butchie Baker all over the city because he was accused of molesting 10 women. There's, you know, that's still their testimony, unless you believe they're all liars. And of course, you know, it caused a hubbub and it provoked city council meetings and so forth. But eventually, he was declared officer of the year and promoted.
Oh, wow.
And he's still on the force. Actually, I won a lawsuit against him about 5 years ago. We wave at each other occasionally, you know. So, but I'm wondering that's
yeah, we go did ahead. This postering campaign after. There was a cop named Scott McAllister who shot and killed a unarmed black woman named Kendra James. And there was a huge amount of stress and turmoil around that in the community. And
you were able to do what you did because of the community's reaction. I mean, I know as cop watchers,
yeah,
we'd like to think we can stir up some concern about these issues, but actually you were following the parade, so to speak.
Yeah, and I mean, really, what we did was we waited until the original period of tension had dissolved, and McAllister was suspended for 6 months, and it was when he was coming back to work that we postered the area where he was going to be working with posters that said, you know, warning, armed killer in area, you know, that sort of thing.
And you announced a photo contest, right?
Yes.
That was that's a brilliant stroke. I think that's wonderful.
Thank you. I personally can't take credit for that, but I'll
very
pass
good.
It on.
Well, whoever did. I actually took the picture of Sergeant Officer Baker at the time and the Java House local cafe at the time, and
Part of it was that.
But I think it's a great idea to have members of the community turn in different photos, and you see who's got the most, telling likeness, whatever.
And part of it was that he had enjoyed a certain amount of anonymity. Like, we knew his name, and we knew how long he had been on the force, but we really knew nothing else about him. We didn't know his disciplinary record. We didn't know you know, where he had worked previously. We didn't know what he looked like, just know nothing about him.
You mean you don't have don't have police trading cards up there like they do down here for a while? Pictures of the police officer?
They've had those in the past, but he didn't have one.
Oh, dear.
But the in contrast, Kendra James, the young woman who was killed, like, everything about her life was on display. Like, you know, her juvenile arrest record, bad things that ex-boyfriends had to say about her, like...
Similar to what's happened with Lovell Mixon and the...
Yes, exactly.
Down
it was
here.
Sort of top to bottom.
And for those who don't know, Lovell Mixon was the African-American who who was killed by police after apparently killing two sets of police officers up in Oakland, about a month and a half ago.
Yeah. We announced the photo contest really as a way of puncturing that sort of anonymity. And it happened that we announced it. It got this huge public furor. The mayor had a press conference and denounced us. The chief of police had a press conference and denounced us. Members of the public got in touch with us with pictures of Scott McAllister.
But there was no prosecution of the officers involved, of course.
No. I mean, there was a grand jury hearing, but that was it.
Has there ever been a prosecution of a police officer who's killed someone on duty in Portland? I know it's
not that I can think of.
It's very rare. I think even in California that there is such a thing. And California, of course, is a larger state. I think they found the newspaper stories didn't mention any previous police officers, you know, actually being tried and convicted. Even for a shooting is rare, but for a murder is just very rare. I'm going to give you an opportunity to kind of sum up, because I want to kind of roll in the last few minutes and also give other people an opportunity again, callers, if anybody out there wants to call, now's the time to do it. And it may be that people are trying to call in, Kristen, but they're not able to because of a phone problem. We have both eccentric phones, and I'm one of the more challenged broadcasters in the collective here. So, the phone number is 469-3119, 469-3119. I know Stephen Percy earlier was looking forward to hearing this. You probably know Stephen. I don't know if you know of him. He's an activist, an attorney in Berkeley and Sacramento who acquired notoriety by hanging some soldiers in effigy from his Sacramento home after the Fallujah. I wouldn't call it an incident, massacre that happened when U.S. troops decimated Fallujah back in 2004 in Iraq. And he was listening. He was looking forward to this. Perhaps he'll call in before you go if he has any questions. But how can people get in touch with you? Let me ask you that. And if they do have questions about this, is there an email address or website they should go to?
My website is www.christianwilliams, that's KristianWilliams.com. And there's an email address there, and my P.O. Box address is there. And, if anybody feels like reaching me, it's not that hard.
Okay, because I'm going to order your book. I've had it out in the library too long. It's www.christianwilliams, that's KristianWilliams, KristianWilliams.com.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being on, and I will probably get in touch with you again and attempt to drag you onto this air again. So.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you. Bye.
And now a little music before we move into the final segment of the show. Call-in number here is, again, 427-3772. You are tuned to 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. That was Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America.
Find ourselves a little cafe.
but
the wine and the
sunshine
blow our minds away. Saturday should be fine. All day long we've been sitting on our islands and looking. Sometimes I wonder if we will ever be happy again. I'll put on my makeup and you shine your shoes. I know that it's Monday, but I'm bored with the blues. Why don't you put on your Saturday suit? Let's fly me away.
That's another Mama Cass number from her album, The Road is No Place for a Lady. So, let's get back to a few street interviews, then I'll read a little bit. Aha, but before I do, looks like there's an incoming call. What a concept. Hi, you're on Free Radio. What's your name?
I'm just a caller.
Hey, caller, what's up?
I've been trying to get the, is it 101? I've been trying to get it on the radio.
It is 101.1 FM.
Uh-huh.
That's our call number. And also you can get us at freakradio.org if you have a computer, www.freakradio.org.
I don't have a computer.
But you, yeah, I know you called earlier, and I know you're kind of a regular caller, and I appreciate your calling in. You've generally not been able to pick us up. You got a question or a comment you want to make about, we've been talking with an author about police power in America and alternatives to the police department that people might be able to use in the future and have used in other places.
Well, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So you have a guest there?
Well, he actually is up in Portland, Oregon. He called in and we talked for about an hour. And if you ever get a chance to get to a computer, these shows are archived at www.huffsantacruz.org. I'm both telling you this and telling the rest of the world, which I, so folks that want to hear what actually was said, you can go back. But what's on your mind?
Oh, I'm interested in finding out what kind of demonstrations you got coming up.
Well, we usually have a cop watch on Saturday at 5 o'clock in front of Borders. It may rain, however, on that day. So if you want to find out, there is actually a protest. This goes for anybody else listening. You should come to the Human Rights Organization meeting at 3 o'clock, 2 hours before. That happens at the Sub Rosa Cafe in downtown Santa Cruz at 703 Pacific, which is about a block from the Saturn Cafe toward the beach. If you
can
know
you
the
walk
down
from there to that other location.
Yeah, to the Borders if you want. It's not far. If we do it, it's possible that we may be rained out, and we're trying to look for more creative places to proceed. I note that the cop watch up in Portland, which did it, which was apparently successful and did kind of, you know, kind of organize itself to get together to deal with problems that came up, like police officers shooting people dead and then the cops covering it up or refusing to you know, give out information about the officer and maligning the victim. And the Rose City Cop Watch then put out, did a photography contest and put out flyers about the police officer who did the killing being armed and dangerous. So maybe one, instead of doing regular weekly cop watches, which we do, we may start doing things which focus on particular events and particular things that come up that the community is upset about, which I think is a good idea too. But yeah, we have a meeting at the Human Rights Organization. It meets every Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, so you can check that one out, caller.
Mm-hmm. I like you.
Yeah. Anything else?
Well, basically that I just having so much trouble getting the station.
Well, keep trying, and, you know, I don't know what to tell you. Maybe you could find a friend who has a – where are you located? What part are you in, Santa Cruz or some other place?
Well, I'm in Aptos.
Yeah, it's harder out in Aptos. Sometimes you can get us out there, and then sometimes it's a little more difficult. So I can understand why you might have problems. If you could find somebody with a computer, that's often the best way to go because it's you can get the stream directly. You can hear it pretty clearly, I understand. And, you know, that's another
option.
Okay,
well, I'll go over there and see if I can, but you're going to be off in about 15 minutes, aren't
yeah,
you?
I am, but I'll be coming back on Sunday at 9:30, so you can hear a much longer show if you want.
Yes. Okay, well, I'll do that. I'll see if I can't get my – I know somebody with the computer.
Okay, that's great.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay.
And let's go back to a few street interviews. This one, I think, is from April 18th. I've been doing catch-up shows, and I maybe have to do another catch-up show, but I'm trying to catch up with a new vehicle, my old vehicle, looks like it's headed for the old vehicle's burial ground. We'll see. Anyway, here's some more street interviews.
Thank you, Sam. I'm here on the tarmac of Trader Joe's talking with...
The unpaid bill.
And the unpaid bill is, of course, talking to me on Saturday morning, the 18th of April, I guess so. 10:20. Go ahead.
I was wondering if anybody noticed that the state legislature, while they were in... when they didn't set our budget and they kept overrunning, they got $187 a month. When you figure out that by the week, it's about $900. The average Social Security recipient gets $900 a month. So each week they wasted a 1 month's salary of a Social Security disabled person. In their times, they managed to take up, and their answer to carrying a cure for the budget is to take away the dental benefits and the medical benefits of the disabled in order to pay for their
Who
time.
Who needs the disabled? We don't need their kind around here.
The physically disabled fit right in well with our city council because they are morally disabled.
Well put. Thank you, unpaid bill. So it's around almost noon on Saturday. I'm passing by the Metro Center, and I see new signs have been put up. Notice all activities monitored by video camera. Aviso, todas actividades son observado por una cámara de video. In blue, no less. So there are new signs up at the Metro indicating video surveillance, which some might regard as intrusive rather than helpful for public safety. Well, criminal behavior. We're talking with
Miguel De Leon.
And Miguel, you yourself have been. Where have you been sleeping at night these days?
I was court ordered to not sleep until May 5th because it would be breaking a law, and the court said break no laws under a court probationary.
Not sleep outside in downtown Santa Cruz.
Well, you know, sleep wherever you sleep is still sleep, no matter what you call it. Or where you try to call it.
So where have you been sleeping? You wish to confess now or
since
later?
Since I got OR'd, I've been trying to keep maintaining the court order to not break any laws, so therefore I have not got very much sleep. So when the sleep debt kicks in...
You may go crazy or postal, as the case may be.
No. I'm very, very much too lazy to be post office worthy.
So last night, have you been to the armory, or have you been to the armory? Is closed, I guess. Have you been to the Interface Satellite Shelter Program, or tried those shelters?
No, not yet, because you know, I think the old vets get the first chance on that shit.
Fair enough. Now, you say that you were caught criminally sitting within 14 feet of a building in violation of a court instruction?
I'm trying my hardest, though, to keep working on my job here and keep the court satisfied with their orders and stuff at the same time, and it gets difficult sometimes. But since I was sitting within 14 feet of a building...
Well, you mean you were accused of sitting, that you haven't been convicted of it, right?
Well, I...
You were cited for it.
I was cited for it, but I thought that was probably all they needed.
Just blackmailing.
And, yeah, it'll probably wash me for breaking the court order.
Who was the officer who cited you for this?
The one with the pin.
Yes, but you know her or his name?
No, they've never told me.
And where did this happen?
Right by the sandwich shop across from the Catalyst.
And what time of day?
Probably about I might have the ticket here somewhere.
Were you blocking traffic?
No, I was in a little nook that's kind of in between a pillar and another pillar on the side of the building.
What did the officer say to you when he or she approached you?
Did you have any identification?
They didn't warn you that it was a criminal behavior to sit within 14 feet of a building in downtown Santa Cruz, unlike any other city in the country?
Well, they expect me to be already knowing because, you know, I am.
They know who you are. Why are they asking for your ID?
Because they don't quite have it all memorized yet, but they're close. I think they only need, like, the height and weight and a Social Security number. I think they're the only ones most of the officers still need to memorize.
You were identified visually as a sit criminal, as well as a sleep criminal.
I'm sure in their private meetings they probably do use terms of that nature.
Well, you know, we have to guard society against the likes of you. So you got a citation for this. Have you gotten any other citations in the last few days?
No, but I can feel a few coming on because, boy, my eyelids are getting heavy.
Well, we hope that you can sleep during the day. You see, that's why Santa Cruz...
I can't. Anybody else can, I believe, but me, I'm not. No, I can't. There's about 15 laws involved.
Park and you sleep during the day, that's generally not violating the law, unless you've been given a specific order not to sleep in parks during the day.
Me, it is. Well, I was given specific orders not to go anywhere near one park.
Which park?
The one across the street from the clock tower because...
Scope Park.
Yeah, because I had awoke one morning after sleeping all night in the rain, in full sprint. And as soon as I was fully awake and conscious... enough to think straight, I realized that there's nowhere to run to, and really, I'm not into running from anybody, so I found an officer and laid down, and they put me in jail.
So you were running from an interloping officer who woke you at Scope Park?
Well, he didn't quite wake me, but I guess he started to, because I woke up full sprint.
So you were sort of sleep running, so to speak.
Definitely. Definitely.
Well, we mentioned to you earlier that every Saturday, well, at least this Saturday, probably next Saturday, at 5 o'clock in front of Borders, there's a cop watch. You think you'll be down there to give us the benefit of your years and experience?
I'm going to give it my full efforts, and I would really like to see a cop watch so I can see how well they can tell time.
Yes, well, we actually have a broken watch, and the cops don't usually show up, but we do give out literature and questionnaires, so you can check us out as we interview the people.
Nice. Since they're public servants, we should be able to get records of their... schedules, and it should make watching them a lot easier.
It should, but often they're in cars, and therefore you have to either have a very fast skateboard or possibly fly to keep up with them.
Well, if we're good enough, maybe we'll gather enough people that we can just have points on the corners they go by and keep a good communications going.
A network of eyes on the street.
Yep, and maybe a hacker or two can tap into all those public police cameras on their cars, and maybe if we're smart, we'll have them mounted to their hats as well, so anybody online can see what that officer is doing at any time, and we can watch them watch us better.
Not to mention cameras on the police in their off-duty hours to see how well they're following the law.
Well, you know, me personally, I believe in privacy, and if they're not at work, then...
An officer is always at work. Now, come on.
They don't need to follow the law if they're not at work, but if they are at work, they really don't need to follow the law because, you know, they're the ones that enforce them, so that gives them their right and leeway.
A very cynical view of our SCPD. Again, we've been talking with...
Miguel De Leon.
A.K.A.
Nobody.
Thank you, Nobody.
All right,
And before we turn to our next interview, a quick comment. This is Miguel De Leon, who, with Anna Richardson, faces a restraining order in the court of Judge Burdick for sleeping downtown. He's gotten about 60 tickets in the last 2 years, a year and a half. I looked over some of the files. He and Anna Richardson, they're a couple of street musicians, and they've gotten tickets mostly for sleeping. and also for being upset that they're getting sleeping tickets and not being terribly nice to the police officers who are giving them, or the little hosts who are helping the police, or the other city workers that are colluding in this effort, however nicely they're colluding, to criminalize homeless people. And so they're due back in the court of Judge Burdick. I believe it's on the 15th that they're due back. And they, I had initially said that he's been given the impossible job of not falling asleep in Santa Cruz, period, which is not really possible, because it's all public property. It's forbidden to fall asleep, even in your own private property if it's parked on public property. And even if it's parked on private property, you can only do it for 3 days per calendar month. I know, it sounds very strange. That's the law in Santa Cruz. So I then learned later, well, it's only the downtown area they don't want him to sleep in. But now I learn from what he's telling me in this interview, as I review it and hear it with you out there at the same time. Often when I give the interviews, I don't get all the information, or some of it passes through me without registering. That the judge also gave him an order to obey all laws downtown. That would mean such laws as not sleeping after 11 o'clock at night anywhere in Santa Cruz whatsoever on any public property. And since there's shelter tonight for only, I don't know, maybe 80 to 100 people at most, probably much less, then you have a situation where he cannot sleep legally anywhere at all, and he's going to have to violate the law or sleep during the day, and apparently the police go after him for that too. So it's an interesting situation. I'm going to actually put on a little music, because I hear a knock at the door from, I think it's probably Uncle Dennis. It's becoming a pounding at the door, shockingly enough. So I want to thank you all for being with me on this edition of Bathurst Spears Broadsides. Come on back on Sunday. We'll be playing some more. We'll be hearing from the Republican National Convention arrestee, the first guy arrested, Vernon Rodriguez. As well as we'll be hearing some Cop Watch adventures of Bernard Klitzner, trying to make a point that you have to be able to sit on a bench, for God's sake, and not have to worry about the meter maid chalking your shoe. So give us a call on the Huff line if you want to come to the Huff meeting or the HRO meeting, which is Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Rosa, the Sub Rosa Cafe. And give me a call at 423-4833 if you got more information, thoughts, complaints, or concerns. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathurst Spears Broadsides.
Town. And do you wonder why? cold wind blow from way down north. Wrap around me for some comfort, and I will keep you warm till the first day of.
Hopefully that's just about all of that. I'm told that's Rare Mama Cass from 1970, something like that, in a once-released and never-re-released album.
The Road is No Way to Treat a Lady.
The Road is No Way to... Are you sure?
The Road is No Place for a Lady.
The Road is No Place for a Lady. And Robert should know. He meets a lot of women on the road. Or is it that you run women off the road?
I try to be helpful wherever I go.
Anyway, Robert will be back on Sunday about 9:30 in the morning or earlier if he can wangle his way into excess hours. And anyway, bye, Robert. If you want to hear more Bathrobe Spears broadsides, I suppose you can... Hey, Robert, do you want to stop your recording? I guess I'll do Robert's recordings for him. I should charge him. Anyway, in case you didn't know it, I am Uncle Dennis. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, www.freakradio.org. And for the next 3 hours, it's one CD player... And I don't know. We're going to have to figure out how to get the CDs into CD1 because the tray won't open or close, but I suppose we'll figure it out. Anyway, music from the 60s and the 70s, from the cream to the dregs, name of this show. 9 o'clock, the Earth First Update. 10 o'clock, we'll have our Spotlight Group of the Week, a whole hour of one artist or group for your entertainment and education. So stay tuned for all of that right here on Free Radio. Support us if you can.